little bit of music over there to get you in the mood as we talk with Jennifer Cheverini. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. Welcome to the Ideas Network. Talking about women telephone operators in World War I. And Jennifer has a new book out. It's called Switchboard Soldiers. Jennifer, of course, a New York Times bestselling author. She's been with us many a time for many of her books. I think almost all of, probably all of her books at one time or another. So it's great to have her with us today. And I hope you'll join in as we visit with her about her book, Switchboard Soldiers. When was someone in your family a telephone operator, maybe? Do you have questions about the women's roles as members of the U.S. Signal Corps? I'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Jennifer Cheverini, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, when I got your book, just recently, by the way, I looked at the cover and I looked at the four women on the cover, the Signal Corps members, and I thought, man, they exude confidence, energy, competence, and friendliness.
Absolutely. Now, those are all very important qualities to have as a telephone operator.
You know, I looked at it, I thought, man, that's a great photo. And then when I finished the book, I looked at the cover again. I thought, man, you captured all that in your book.
Oh, well, thank you. I really tried to. One of the things that was so important to me as I was writing the story was really doing honor and paying tribute to these just absolutely remarkable women who just blazed all kinds of trails and were just so proud and of their contributions as what they believed themselves to be, the first women to serve in the United States Army.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. How did you get involved or interested in the first place?
Well, like with so many of my other novels, I came across the inspiration and the idea for this book while I was researching a previous novel. You know, I stumble over a new historical event, new to me, or a really remarkable historical figure. And I think, oh, after I'm done here, I've got to go back to that and explore that idea further. And while I was researching my previous novel, while I was researching and writing The Women's March, which is about the 1913 woman suffrage procession, I was reading a historian's account of the suffrage movement in the U.S. in the early 20th century, and the author noted that Woodrow Wilson was so impressed with the way that American women had conducted themselves during World War I that he completely reversed his position on the question of women's suffrage, and whereas he had been absolutely opposed to the idea before, now he not only approved of it, but he advocated before the constitutional amendment for women to get the right to vote. And my first reaction was, wait a minute, are we talking about the same Woodrow Wilson? Because he didn't even like women speaking in public.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what is it that women did during World War I that so impressed him that would change the mind of someone who was so opposed to giving women the right to vote? And I was familiar with Rosie the Riveter from World War II and how women on the World War II home front stepped up and filled in for men who had gone off to war in so many professions that were closed to them. But I hadn't really learned much about what women did during the Great War, during World War I. So I began doing research to learn, you know, did women even then, a generation before Rosie the Riveter, step up and fill in and support their country however they could? And I found out that indeed they did, perhaps not on as large a scale, because the different scale of the U.S. involvement in the war. But certainly they did step up, and they worked as factory workers and streetcar conductors here on the home front. But what fascinated me most was the story of the women who served as telephone operators for the U.S. Army Signal Corps.
And it was a crucial role.
It absolutely was. Again, going back to World War II, I think we're familiar with a lot of military commands and communications between military bases and soldiers at the front being conducted by radio. Well, the radio hadn't been invented by World War I, of course, but the golden age of radio didn't come along until the 1920s. So all of these communications, almost all of them, took place by telephone. Now, there were communications that took place by runners. A messenger would carry it, or even by homing pigeon.
Yeah.
But the vast majority was conducted by telephone. And in those days, you've probably seen them in newsreels and in old movies. You have this large switchboard with all of these different jacks and cables and blinking lights. And a light would go off on the switchboard to indicate that someone was placing an outgoing call. And then you have all these women, because they were almost always women, yeah, seated at these high stools with their headsets and microphones on. And they would, whoever's call it was, would plug the jack in, ask the caller for their number, and then they would reach, maybe sometimes right in front of them. Maybe they have to stretch past the other telephone operator to connect that cable into the corresponding jack. And then they would listen, make sure that the caller had picked up, make sure everything would be fine, and then they would disengage. And by then, the switchboard was lighting up with another call. Well, this was how all of the military commands, communications between headquarters and supply bases at the rear, calls between American bases and their counterparts with the French and British armies, all of that was done by the telephone. So you needed not only the very best technology, which the United States had at the time, but you also needed the best operators.
Very best.
Absolutely. To connect these calls accurately, swiftly, and, you know, perfectly every time.
And General Pershing, I, and of course, we didn't get into the war right away, as you note. But when we did, General Pershing, who was kind of in charge, mm-hmm, of everything, requested that he wanted women to fill that role.
Right. When he went over in 1917, in early 1917, to begin establishing the United States infrastructure there in France, he learned very early on that the communications were going to be a problem unless improvements were made swiftly. So I said America had the best telephone technology at the time. In comparison, a lot of the French technology was rather antiquated. And they had been subject to war since 1914. So a lot of it had been damaged through bombings and just not being able to get resources to make repairs. So General Pershing found that he was not going to be able to communicate well unless he had American technology brought over and he had highly trained, highly skilled operators at the switchboards to connect all these calls. So at first, there were no women allowed in the U.S. Army.
No.
The Navy was ahead of the Army. They had already begun enlisting women to serve as Yeoman F, for yeoman female,
yeah,
or as the popular nickname was, yeomanettes. So they served in clerical positions and office positions to free up men to go to sea, but the Army was not enlisting women. So what they did is the Signal Corps started training soldiers, GIs, to serve on the switchboard. And they often trained telegraph operators because they thought they were analogous skills. Now, the men at the switchboards could connect a call in about a minute.
A minute.
And that sounds very good until you realize that back in the States, a highly skilled, well-trained female operator could do it in 10 seconds. And when you think about how, you know, seconds can mean the difference when you're issuing military commands between success and defeat, between lives saved and massive casualties. Well, you can understand why General Pershing wasn't willing to just let that 50 seconds go. So he told the U.S. Army, I need the best telephone operators you can get, and I need them over here immediately. They had no choice but to recruit women.
Women. And that's kind of where your book, you have three women who that are highlighted, although I think there's a fourth kind of too, Inez Crittenden.
Right.
I, played a very prominent role and was, in fact, a person who was, I mean, she was real mm-hmm. person for sure. But what I loved about about your book is you talk about through the eyes of these women and the experiences of these women, what they had to go through.
Yes.
Just to be selected.
Oh,
but
absolutely.
Then also, how many women wanted to go?
Well, many more wanted to go than actually made it, even through the first round. So there were three very important criteria that applicants had to meet before they could qualify. And the first, of course, was that they had to be excellent telephone operators, or they had to be able to learn so quickly that they could pass themselves off. You know, they could learn on the job really quickly. But most of them were very skilled, experienced telephone operators. Secondly, and this was the criterion that kept a lot of women who otherwise would have longed to go, just even from applying, they had to be fluent in French. They had to be not just you got an A in high school French class.
No.
You had to be absolutely fluent. And this was because the telephone operators in France would also be connected to the French government telephone system. And they would often be connecting calls between American officers and French officers. And sometimes the two men couldn't speak to each other. So not only would the telephone operator have to connect the call, but she would also have to translate on the spot as the conversation was in progress. And every single word had to be perfect. Again, because of the important critical information they were conveying.
You're hearing it in English, and then you have to translate it to French
right.
on the spot.
Exactly.
And you gave there were some examples, you know, that are sprinkled in. It's fairly detailed information that
right.
you're on the spot.
Right.
You had to do it.
And you had to translate it back, too.
Right.
You know, but then there was a third criterion that was very important, too. The candidates had to be absolutely loyal to the United States and to the Allies. And they also had to be clever. So not because they were dealing with mm-hmm. important military secrets. So they had to be eminently trustworthy so that they wouldn't deliberately give away any military secrets. But they also had to be clever enough not to be tripped up into unintentionally divulging anything that had to be secret. So they had to be utterly discreet.
You know, there is one other criteria that they had, and that which surprised me a bit, and that was that they had to have permission.
Yes.
From their, if they were young and not married, they had to have permission from their father.
Yes.
I suppose. I don't know if the mother could give
permission. If she were widowed, then yes, yes. If there was no father present, then yes.
And
they had permission from their mother. Yes.
And what really surprised me, even I could hardly believe it, if you were 30 years old, you still had to get permission.
Yes. Well, this was the status of women in 1917, 1918. Most of them could not even vote yet. It really depended which state you lived in, because several states, especially out in the West, had already granted women the right to vote, but not everywhere. So, you know, it was women's options and women's rights were severely curtailed back in the day.
Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, her latest book is titled Switchboard Soldiers, a novel of the heroic women who served in the U.S. Army Signal Corps during World War I. That's the subtitle of it. Great book, and I'm having fun talking with her. If questions for her or comments or maybe an experience, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Trina LaSusa, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at Jennifer Cheverini's latest book. It's a dandy. It's titled Switchboard Soldiers. Questions or comments for her as we go along? I hope you'll join in. The number 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. www.thebookshop.org. So just the selection process, and you told through the experiences of the three women, maybe talk a little bit more about that.
Sure.
Because they had to learn a lot.
Well, yes, it was difficult. But even when the women had been told very clearly in these advertisements that went out focusing on a lot of industry publications like Pacific Telephone News or Bell mm-hmm. Telephone News, you know, really focusing in on reaching current telephone operators, they were warned that this was going to be challenging, difficult work. And even if you were based in Paris was being bombarded by the German long guns. So it was not going to be, you know, they made it clear that it was going to be hardship duty. And if you were located closer to the front, it would be even more dangerous and hazardous. But even knowing that their lives would be in jeopardy, 7,600 women applied to move on in the process, hopefully to be selected. And out of all of those, a smaller number were chosen to go for additional training at several stations, several bases throughout the U.S. There was one in San Francisco, in Chicago, in New York City. And there, the candidates would be given additional training on a variety of switchboards so that they would be familiar with anything that they might be assigned to over there. And they were tested very rigorously on their French skills. And then they also underwent physical training, calisthenics and such like that, and medical evaluations to make sure they were up to the challenges that they would face when they were deployed. And out of that 7,600 who applied, 223 were chosen. It was narrowed down to that. And then the first group was 33 women. And they were the very first group that was sent over in March of 1918 from Hoboken, New Jersey, then on to the UK, and from there they went on to France. And some of them were sent to Paris, others were deployed at General Pershing's headquarters closer to the front, and then others were settled elsewhere in France at services of supply bases further to the rear. And then every few weeks or so, another group of switchboard soldiers who were prepared to get to work would sail over. And they faced all of the same hazards during that ocean crossing as the troops did.
Yeah.
With the German U-boats patrolling the waters. And then in the spring, but even more acutely in the fall of 1918, the spread of the influenza.
Yeah. It was fascinating. Tell us about Grace Banker.
Well, Grace Banker is one of my three narrators, and she is inspired by an actual historical figure. And the real Grace Banker was a native of New Jersey, and she was a college graduate. She had majored in French, and she was employed at the AT&T headquarters in Manhattan. And she was so successful, the telephone operator, that she had been promoted to the rank of instructor. And then she was very, very patriotic, very loyal to her country. So when the call went out for women with this very particular set of skills, and she knew there would not be a lot of qualified people, you know, who are great telephone operators and fluent in French, she really felt it was her duty to apply. And she did, and she sailed through all of the preliminary evaluations. And so much so that at the age of 25, she was appointed the chief operator of that first unit and first group. So at only 25, she was responsible for organizing and leading and, you know, managing this group of 32 other women. In their first night in Paris, the hotel right next to them was bombed, and she was responsible. Yes, and, you know, just a few feet to the left, and it would have been them. And she was just so exceptional in her skills and so much grace and intelligence under pressure that every time the front would shift eastward and the headquarters would move along with it. Grace was always one of the handful of operators that was chosen to move with them. Yes, and it was this, you know, often a very makeshift telephone exchange that she was sent to. And eventually, she was decorated with the Distinguished Service Medal for her exemplary performance in incredibly dangerous conditions.
Absolutely fantastic, and you bring it to life as in your writing. How did you rely, or how much, to what extent did you rely on history to bring, because you're bringing conversations in.
Sure.
This is a novel, so.
right. Well, when you're writing historical fiction, you do have to invent a lot.
Sure.
Whether it's fictional characters, like some of my narrators, and then many of the secondary figures in the book, or if you're imagining innermost thoughts and private conversation, things that didn't enter in the historical record. And this is one of the things I love about writing historical fiction, is you do get to imagine. Whereas history, straight, you know, historical nonfiction, you do focus on what happened, and of course you provide analysis and you draw conclusions. But with historical fiction, the emphasis is more on what was that experience like for the people living it, or for a person who maybe didn't really exist but might have, and trying to really put your reader in their shoes so that they can experience it through their eyes. And that's what I love about, it's not so much what happened as what was it like to be there? What did it feel like to experience it?
Yeah, and that's what I love about your books.
That's what I love about writing them.
that's for sure. Well, let's mention the other, Marie Miosic?
Yes. And I confess that I took the last name from my pen pal, my French pen pal, that I had when I was in elementary school and in middle school. So that's where I got her last name. And yes, Marie is like so many of the switchboard soldiers, so many of these telephone operators, some of them were like Grace Banker, who studied French and learned it, you know, in a classroom. Yeah. But others were recent immigrants or first-generation Americans, the children of immigrants from France or Belgium. And my character, Marie, she wasn't really expecting to stay in America very long. She came with her family, a family of musicians, so that they could, her parents could teach at the conservatory in Cincinnati. And Marie has her own dreams of becoming an opera singer, but her family was really only planning to stay in the U.S. for a few years. But then the war came, and it was really too impossible for the family to go back. So Marie is an aspiring opera singer herself, but, you know, until she can get that job with an opera company, she is working as a telephone operator in order to contribute to the household while she's going to auditions and trying to make her way like that. And then one of my other characters is a immigrant from an immigrant family from Belgium.
Valerie.
And she has, she really took to California life after her. She moved as a very young child to Southern California in Los Angeles. And she just loves it. And she's very mathematically inclined. She had dreams of a college education, but that got curtailed when her father passed away. So to help support the family, she became a switchboard operator in LA and just absolutely loved it. Not only did she enjoy the fast-paced, high-pressure work, but she just really loved the independence that it gave her, having her own income, being self-sufficient. And that's really what these telephone operator jobs gave to so many young women, that sense of freedom. And, you know, even though they, you know, they had to get their father's permission to sign a lease or anything, like, you know, things of that sort, it really did give them a new sense of freedom and self-sufficiency and independence that their mother's generation didn't know.
So explain a little bit about the Signal Corps itself. The women who served were at officer level, but they, explain, they weren't quite the same.
Right. Well, they didn't know, the U.S. Army didn't really quite know what to do with women in their ranks suddenly. And there was a lot of discussion about, well, you know, should they salute? Should they be saluted? I mean, they're not enlisted men, obviously, but they're above military cadets. So it was eventually decided that, okay, well, we will consider them to have the status of officers, much as we do with nurses. And but, you know, the U.S. Signal Corps, of course, was much more vast than the telephone operators alone. And, of course, the Signal Corps had been around for many decades.
Yeah.
And it also included a lot of men who came from the civilian telephone profession. And even before the U.S. went to war, a lot of the telephone companies like AT&T and like Pacific Telephone kind of saw what was coming. So they began establishing reserve telephone corps groups, so they out of their own employees, just to prepare them to go over there to be linemen, to set up the telephone exchanges, so that if the U.S. did go to war, they would be able to get the men over there right away to start building this infrastructure. And it turned out that it was a very good thing that they were prepared for that, because a lot of the Signal Corps men, as soon as General Pershing went over, they deployed as well. And they had a very, very difficult job, too, especially the linemen, because they had to, you know, there weren't any satellites that you could connect your cell phone
right.
to. You had to have a physical wire that would be rolled out, you know, and, you know, while you're under sniper fire, you're trying to lay this wire. And sometimes you're putting up a telephone pole. Other times you're putting that wire on a fence post or in a tree or in a specially dug trench. And those are very challenging jobs as well.
And dangerous because, I mean, during battles or whatever, the German army might cut the line.
Exactly.
Right in the middle of a battle, you've got to go in there and fix the line.
Absolutely. And sometimes it could happen accidentally. Sometimes it would happen intentionally. And also with these lines, they could be tapped into by the enemy. And then, you know, which all of your military orders and secrets are subject to being overheard. So the telephone operators were trained, the women back at the switchboards were trained to listen very carefully for anything that didn't sound right on the line, just in case that line had been tapped.
And there were so many things that they had to be really careful about what they said. I mean,
yes.
You couldn't even mention the weather.
Right. Anything that might divulge where they were, what was going on. There were so many code names and code words that were used, and they changed frequently just to keep everything as absolutely confidential as possible.
And they had to learn and understand those as they changed.
Right. Absolutely.
While they were, frankly, working.
Right. In addition to everything else they had to do, which was already quite a high pressure, difficult job, they also had to keep in mind all of the new terminology, not only in English, but also in French. And, you know, absolutely keep everything as confidential as possible. And sometimes some of the officers that they worked with, especially if they were in intelligence, would test them. Just like if they saw them walking around in the base, they would say, oh, so, you know, I'm trying to do the staffing, and I understand you girls are going to be moving up closer to the front soon. Is that going to be on Thursday, or is that not till next week? And then they would have to be, oh, I have no idea, sir. I mean, you would know more than I. And, you know, they'd have to just, even if they knew exactly what they were being asked, they had to just keep mum and not let a single secret out.
There were so many little things that they had to remember. I was struck when, just on the numbers, the Americans would say, get me 4732. But if it was from a French, you had to say 4,372.
Right.
And remember all that stuff.
Right. It was just a different approach to taking the number. And, you know, the American women very quickly had to learn to adapt to that system because you couldn't slow anything down. You know, you couldn't spend 10 seconds translating in your head. You had to be able to do that immediately.
And just an idea. During a battle, well, all the time it was busy, but during a battle it was even worse. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of calls coming.
Yes.
One
absolutely.
Right after the other.
Right. And sometimes, you know, calls were cut off because there was a bombardment on the other end. Sometimes the women themselves, especially if they were closer to the front, they were sitting at their stations while their own buildings were being shelled. And in one, you know, very alarming incident that happened, the women were at their switchboard, and this is where Grace Banker experienced this. There was a prisoner of war who set a fire in an adjacent building. He was being used in custodial work, in which, you know, on second thought, maybe they should rethink that policy. Yeah. And he started a fire, and the fire began to spread from wooden building to wooden building. But the women, and, you know, ashes and cinders were falling from and, you know, being carried on the air and landing on their roof. So they are sitting at their switchboard placing these calls while their building is beginning to burn. And they would not leave their stations because they knew that if these calls didn't get through, it meant that the boys in the trenches, the boys in the front, it could cost them their lives. And so it wasn't until one of their superior officers ordered them out with the threat of court-martial did they finally flee the building. And even after that, you know, and then, you know, in the meantime, everyone else was trying to douse the flames and haul the switchboard equipment out of the building to try to save it. And the lines were down for an hour. But as soon as they could douse the flame and get those switchboards back up again, the women were back at work. And then they were getting angry messages from switchboard operators at other bases. Why did you let your lines go silent for an hour? Don't you understand what danger you put everybody in? But they could not divulge we had a fire here. They could not even divulge that much information because someone listening could figure out, so that's where General Pershing is. And they could not let that get away. So they had to accept the criticism and accept the blame because they could not even tell other telephone operators at a different base what serious jeopardy they had been in at their own switchboards.
And just to give an idea of the magnitude of the number of calls, you say at the end of the book, you note that those women, and now there were 223 of them, answered 25 million?
Oh, I think that's it. I would have to.
It's 25
millions. It was certainly millions of calls.
It was 25 million calls they took. Those women took in the 2 years?
Well, they...
Or the 3 years of the war?
Well, the first women went over in March of 1918.
Okay.
But even after the armistice, and quite far into 1919, the switchboard operators remained because someone had to be connecting all the calls for the peace conference in Paris, and someone had to be handling all of that while all the diplomats were there and the terms were being discussed. And then also, the switchboard operators remained while all of the American soldiers, all the troops and sailors, were being returned to the United States.
Yeah, they went home first.
Right, right. And they, you know, someone had to be there connecting all those phone calls. So the women of the U.S. Army Signal Corps were some of the last soldiers, some of the last American troops, and they also, of course, served with the Army of Occupation in Germany. So they were some of the first to get there and some of the last to leave.
Yeah. And we've talked a lot about facts and the procedures, but I'm feeling remiss here and not talking more about the personal parts of this because it was so interesting for me to get that first person kind of experience that you do so well.
And this is one of the things I so love about historical fiction, because you really do feel what the characters are feeling, you know, their excitement at pride at being the first women to do something, the first American women to do something no one else had done before. The pride in serving their country, their, you know, nervousness at will they be selected or will they be sent home in disgrace because they didn't meet one of the qualifications, and you know, the fear during that ocean crossing and the apprehension while the building is being bombed, while they're trying, just making those calls. And then, of course, the exhilaration and relief when the war was finally ended, when peace finally came. And I'm so impressed, when I was researching and learning about these women, I was so impressed by their daring and their courage and their everything, and this, their willingness to risk their lives to give their skills and give their, you know, all of their hard work just to try to bring the war to a close so that the suffering would end, the fighting would end, France would be free, Belgium would be free again, and normal life could resume. And also just their, just to see their transformation as, you know, maybe they left their small town and they see, oh, there's this whole other world out there. And they had already thought themselves pretty, you know, pretty sophisticated because they were working women, you know, they had jobs. But then to be able to travel when so many of them had never even left their own state, and to be able to go overseas and serve their country with honor and with dignity, the more I read about them, the more I wondered, first of all, why don't we all already know about them? You know, why weren't we taught about them in schools? But now that I do know about them, I hope to share their stories so that it will serve as a tribute to everything that they were willing to sacrifice. Because not all of the telephone operators made it back. Most of them did return to the United States safely and resume their civilian lives, but not all of them made it.
Inez Crittenden was one.
Yes, she was.
And I thought, as I, when I finished the book and then looked back at the cover again and saw how well you had brought what is shown on the cover to life for me, and I'm sure for any other readers, I thought, you know, this would be a great, this could be a great movie, or even better, maybe even better, a Netflix series.
Hey, if you have any connections, just feel free to send them a copy of the book. Yeah, I think that would be so, so exciting.
Wouldn't that be?
Yeah.
I you know. There's so much there.
Yeah, HBO limited series. You know, I'm totally ready for that.
Well, listen, you.
But until then, you can really enjoy a good book.
You certainly can.
I love books. I love reading. And so this is what I can give people today. And I'll let you know if Netflix comes calling.
Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, and her book, I hope you get a chance to look at it. It's titled Switchboard Soldiers, a novel of, the subtitle, a novel of the heroic women who served in the U.S. Army Signal Corps during World War I. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you very much.
And, you know, we're going to continue talking about the role of women and zero in on Wisconsin women service members from World War I to the present. As a matter of fact, Jennifer did get a Green Bay a Green Bay mention in her book. You always do. You try to get a Wisconsin mention in there, don't you? What one point or another?
Yes, you know, it's a bit self-indulgent maybe, but I love to work Wisconsin into my novels whenever I can. So yes, I do have a character named Martina, who was an actual historical figure. Her father had come to the Green Bay area to serve and to teach and perform. He was a musician in a conservatory there. And she and her sister both became telephone operators in Madison and Milwaukee. And they both applied to be in the U.S. Signal Corps, and they both made it. But I include Martina as one of my characters.
Great story. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
She will, at some point, I'm sure, there'll be another book coming, and we'll have her you're back. But is there another book coming? Or
yes, actually, I have another book that will be coming out in July of 2023. And as you probably already guessed, I came across that idea while I was researching and writing Switchboard Soldiers. And while my characters from this novel were in the UK, I needed to do research about that area so I could represent that accurately. And my novel is called Canary Girls, and it comes from the nickname given to the women munitions workers, or munitionettes, who filled in for all of the men when they went off to war on the factory lines. And they worked with TNT, filling shells. And not only was this material very explosive, but it also was fairly toxic, and it colored their skin yellow, and so that's how they got that nickname.
Wow. Yeah. Well, we'll learn more about that, I'm sure, in probably another year.
In another year.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Well, we are going to continue, as I said, talking about women's service members, and this time we'll look directly at Wisconsin women's service members from World War I to the present, as we talk with Jennifer Van Haften from the Wisconsin Veterans Museum in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.